Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners. Hello again from Washington. It's time to learn and improve your American English skills. Today we go back into the classroom with Jonathan Evans and Jill Robbins to talk about some very important parts of speech that you need to know. Then, after today's lesson, we will give you a chance to use what you have learned as we hear about tourism in Iran, as restrictions against the country are eased. So, let's get to work. Here is part one.
From VOA, Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. In an earlier program, we talked about the relative pronouns who, that, and which. We promised to give you more details about how to use relative clauses. In this episode, we look at how the relative adverbs where, when, and why are used. Let's take a look at how relative adverbs work. An adverb is a word that describes a verb, an adjective, another adverb, or a sentence. It is often used to show time, manner and place, or degree. The relative pronouns where, when, and why act as adverbs when they join sentences or clauses. Take these two sentences.
This is a swimming pool. I used to swim in the pool.
Notice how you can put the sentences together with the word where. This is the pool where I used to swim.
Another way to say that is, this is the pool in which I used to swim. That is a formal way and usually only found in writing. We use the relative adverb where, to show the place of an action. The relative adverb when tells about the time of an action. Let's look at an example from The Logical Song by the rock group Supertramp.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle, oh, it was beautiful, magical. And then they showed me
the singer says that life was wonderful when he was young. Later, he uses another adverb to show the world where he could be dependable. A more formal way to say that would be, they showed me a world in which I could be dependable.
We often want to tell the reason for an action. This week, President Obama visited Alaska and talked about melting ice. So much ice is melting in Alaska, he said, that sea levels are rising quickly. Here's how he put it.
The pace of melting is only getting faster. It's now twice what it was between 1950 and 2000. Twice as fast as it was just a little over a decade ago. And it's one of the reasons why sea levels rose by about 8 inches over the last century. And why are they projected to rise another 1 to 4 feet this century?
President Obama made one sentence from these two ideas.
Ice is melting very quickly. Sea levels rose about 8 inches in the last 100 years.
His speech has another clause with a relative adverb that combines these ideas.
Ice is melting very quickly. Scientists predict that sea levels will rise even more.
The words the reason or the reasons often appear before the relative adverb why, but sometimes they are left out, as in President Obama's speech.
And why are they projected to rise another 1 to 4 feet this century?
Are you ready to try some sentences on your own? Put together these sentences with relative adverbs.
The coffee house is in my neighborhood. He got a job in a coffee house.
Is your answer like this? The coffee house where he got a job is in my neighborhood. Here's another one.
I got home from work. I saw the dogs playing in the yard.
One way to put these ideas together is, I saw the dogs playing in the yard when I got home from work.
Finally, let's put these two sentences together.
The dogs frightened the cat. The cat ran up the tree.
Combine these ideas as, the dogs are the reason why the cat ran up the tree.
You will sometimes hear that instead of why after the word reason, as in,
the dogs are the reason that the cat ran up the tree.
We leave you with Earth, Wind, and Fire singing Reasons.
Ooh, baby, I can't find the reasons why my love, it won't disappear. Can't find the reasons why I love you. Hey, I love you.
For Voice of America Learning English Everyday Grammar, I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. The United States and other countries plan to begin easing economic restrictions against Iran next year. The easing of sanctions is part of the deal between six world powers and Iran to limit its nuclear activities. Iranians hope that the end of travel restrictions will lead to more foreigners visiting the country. In London, travel agents say some people are already asking how they can visit Iran. Christopher Jones-Cruz reports.
Tour companies say very few non-Iranians have ever been to Iran. They describe the country as one of the unexplored jewels of the Middle East. They say the countryside is beautiful and its people friendly. Foreigners have stayed away from Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. In 2013, just 90,000 people from North America and European Union countries visited Iran. Mehrdad Konsari works at Iran's Organization for Economic Reconstruction and National Reconciliation.
The difficulties we've had in Iran has definitely hurt the tourist industry in the sense that people are afraid to go. But those people that ventured and, you know, overcame these considerations and visited Iran were never sorry.
The nuclear deal reached in July is already helping to ease travel restrictions. Johnny Bielby founded Wild Frontiers Travel, a British travel agency. He says the agreement has led to an increase in interest in Iran.
Two things have happened since the nuclear deal. First of all, the Foreign Office had changed their advice against travel to Iran, and that's made it much simpler for people to get insurance and that sort of thing. So the numbers have gone up again. We've had to put on three extra departures this year alone to cope with the demand for the autumn season to Iran.
British traveller Bugsy Heath-Brown is joining one of those tour groups.
We decided to get on one of the first trips that we could to get out there, see the sights, meet the people before the big rush of the rest of the world.
Iran says it hopes to have 20 million visitors a year by 2025. Mr. Konsari says those tourists could spend up to $30 billion.
Now that this outside face of Iran is beginning to change, that I think the tourism offers a great opportunity for the Iranian economy.
Tour operators in the West say getting permission from Iranian officials to enter the country is still difficult. Sanctions are still in place, limiting the ability of banks in Iran to operate outside the country. As a result, most payments have to be made in cash. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The World Health Organization reports that hundreds of millions of people have a mental health disorder, but receive little or no treatment. A new WHO report finds that very little of the money spent on health care goes to treating those with mental conditions. The WHO's Mental Health Atlas 2014 is the most complete look at the state of mental health around the world. It contains data from 171 countries, representing 95% of the world's population. The Atlas says that mental conditions are responsible for about 10% of the world's health burden. In other words, 10% of all people have a mental disorder. However, only 1% of the healthcare workforce worldwide is working in mental health. The report finds every country, area, age group, and part of society suffers greatly from mental disorders. Yet, it says, total spending on mental health is extremely low. It also says very few nurses and other healthcare specialists want to work in the mental health field. People of all levels of society can suffer from mental illness. However, the Atlas finds that the financial and healthcare divide between poor and rich countries is very wide. The report says there is, on average, one mental health care provider for every 100,000 people in poor and middle-income countries. The ratio in wealthy countries is 1 per 2,000 people. Worldwide spending on mental health also is very low. The report notes poor countries spend less than $2 per person each year on mental health, compared to more than $50 in wealthy countries. The WHO says mental health disorders are continuing to grow. They estimate that one in four people have a problem at some point in his or her life. The WHO warns health systems are failing to meet the needs of these people, and that failure to help people, it says, is having serious after effects. The WHO warns that depression will be the leading cause of disease burden by 2030. Data from the Mental Health Atlas 2014 shows 900,000 people took their own life each year. The report says suicide is the second most common cause of death among young people. It finds 3 out of 4 people with severe mental disorders receive no treatment. It also says people with mental health problems suffer a wide range of human rights violations. The WHO says it is better to treat people with mental disorders in a small community-based environment instead of something larger. Unfortunately, the organization notes that the majority of spending, about 82%, goes to large mental hospitals. These hospitals serve a small amount of those who need mental health care. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the presidential election of 1804. Thomas Jefferson, the nation's third president, was easily re-elected. Jefferson was head of the Democratic Republican Party, known today as the Democratic Party. Thomas Jefferson had a very good record during his first term as president. He ended many taxes. He paid government debts. And he gained possession of the huge Louisiana Territory from France without going to war. His political opponents were the Federalists. The Federalists were sure Jefferson would win the election of 1804. Still, they were surprised by the strength of his victory. Jefferson won 162 electoral votes. His Federalist opponent won just 14. In the early 1800s, Britain and France were at war with each other. The United States remained neutral. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says President Jefferson did not want to become involved in a war.
He was sufficiently pro-French that he didn't want to ally with the British, but not so pro-French that he wanted a war with the British.
Jefferson also believed getting involved in a European war would destroy all the progress he had made at home. His economic policies had helped to pay much of America's national debt, and he was able to reduce taxes. But staying neutral was not easy. The United States was having trouble with Britain. For many years, Britain had been taking men by force to serve in its navy. Britain claimed the right to seize any British citizen anywhere. The custom was called impressment. Conditions in the Royal Navy were not good at that time, and many sailors deserted. Some went to work on American ships. The American ships were stopped and searched in British waters. Anyone born in Britain was seized. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says sometimes American citizens were also taken.
There was also still something of an imperial attitude in Britain towards America. You know, they were still insisting that some American citizens had been born British. It was often difficult for them to be able to distinguish between their own subjects and Americans.
Several thousand sailors were taken off American ships during the early 1800s. In 1807, an incident made relations between Britain and America even more tense. Britain believed that four of its sailors had deserted and fled to an American ship called the Chesapeake. The United States said the men were American citizens who had been forced to serve in the British Navy. The United States refused to return them. When the Chesapeake sailed out of American waters, the British ship Leopard tried to stop and search it. The American captain would not stop. First, the British ship fired two warning shots. Then, it fired all its guns directly at the Chesapeake.
Beep.
The American ship could do little to defend itself. The captain surrendered. News of the British attack spread quickly. President Jefferson ordered all British Navy ships in American waters to leave at once. He told people not to aid the British. He said any person, American or British, who disobeyed his orders would be arrested. In response, the British government announced a new rule. It said any American ship sailing to Europe must stop first in Britain to get permission. Ships violating the rule would be seized. Relations between the two countries were reaching the breaking point. Impressment was just one of the major problems the United States was having with Britain in the early 1800s. Another problem was trade. Britain wanted to stop the United States from trading with France and its colonies. British warships blocked the port of New York all through 1805. No American ship could leave without being searched. Any ship found to be carrying goods for France was taken north to Halifax, Nova Scotia. There, a British court had the power to seize the goods and force the ship's owners to pay a large fine. In the closing days of 1807, President Thomas Jefferson signed a bill banning all trade with Europe. No ships could enter or leave the United States. Jefferson did not believe that trade embargoes were the best way to settle America's problems with other nations, but at the time, he thought an embargo was the only way to deal with Britain and France short of war, and he did not want war. Jefferson later explained why he thought the embargo was the best choice of action. He said, if American ships had sailed out of American waters, they would have been seized by Britain or France. That would have forced the United States into war. Jefferson said it was far better to stop all contact with these nations until they returned to some sense of justice. Jefferson acted to protect American traders, ship owners, and sailors. Yet those were the people who protested the loudest against the ban. They were willing to take the chance of having Britain or France seize their ships and goods. They could not make any money without trade. The situation quickly turned into a political battle between the Jeffersonian Republicans and the opposition Federalists. Federalist newspapers attacked Jefferson. They called him a tool of France and its leader. They charged that Jefferson supported the trade ban to help Napoleon Bonaparte. One Federalist senator wrote a pamphlet against the embargo. He urged northeastern states to refuse to enforce it. Then he went even further. He met secretly with a British official who was sent to Washington to discuss the situation. He told the British official that Jefferson would be forced out of office because of the embargo. Jefferson simply wished to give the trade embargo a fair chance. He considered the embargo less evil than war. But after a time, he thought, this will not be so. If the war should continue in Europe, and if Britain and France continue to act against us, then it would be for Congress to say if war would not be better than the embargo. Jefferson hoped that the loss of American trade would force Britain and France to change their policies toward the United States. And he hoped the change would come quickly. He knew that the American people would not accept a long ban on trade. A British traveler visiting New York City described what the embargo had done. "The port is full of ships, but all of them are closed. Only a few sailors can be seen. Many of the counting houses are closed. The coffee houses are almost empty. The streets near the water are almost deserted. Grass has begun to grow upon the docks." America's northern industrial states felt the loss of trade most deeply. But the agricultural South also was affected. Rich southern farmers and planters suddenly found themselves poor. Tobacco was one of their major crops, and Britain bought more American tobacco than any other country. Because of the embargo, the price of tobacco fell so low that it had almost no value. The price of wheat fell from $2 a bushel to 7 cents a bushel. Good farmland dropped in value until it was worth almost nothing. Opposition to the embargo was growing. The opposition was strongest in the Northeast. Ship owners and traders believed that the embargo was wrong. They continued to export goods secretly. Some traders began sending goods over land to Canada. From there, the goods were sent on to Britain. Congress passed a law against this kind of trade, but the shipments did not stop. Too many people were willing to violate the law for the large amounts of money they could make by trading secretly with Britain. By August 1808, Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin had lost all hope that the embargo would be successful. Gallatin told President Jefferson that the embargo was defeated by open violations. Another of Jefferson's supporters gave the president some advice. If the embargo could be enforced, and if the people would accept it, then I am sure it would be the wisest course. But if it cannot be enforced completely, and if the people will not accept it, then it will not serve its purpose and should not be continued. Jefferson, however, was not ready to give up his plan. In his last State of the Union message to Congress, he painted a bright picture of the nation. He reported that American industry was making progress. Many goods that had been imported before the embargo were now being made at home. He said almost all of the national debt had been paid, and he said more than 100 gunboats had been built, enough, he declared, to defend the country. Jefferson said nothing about opposition to the embargo, nor did he talk about the serious economic problems caused by it. He said only that Britain and France still refused to honor American neutrality, and so the embargo must continue. The rest of the nation was not so sure. Congress began debating a number of proposals to either lift or amend the embargo. In the first months of 1809, Congress finally approved a bill. The bill lifted the ban on trade with all European countries except Britain.